My name is Eric Jorgensen. I'm your host, and I'm the founder of the True North Disability Planning Company. Through that company, I help families and professionals navigate the maze of benefits, resources, and services as it relates to disability planning for individuals and their children who are moderately to significantly impacted by their disability. Today, I'm bringing back Kim Martin, a special needs attorney based in Georgia. She's a partner with Harrison Held. I'm going to have a link to the last episode where we talked about divorce and special needs. We're going to do a deep dive into her favorite trust provisions. So if you're looking for an overview of what a first party and a third party trust is, this is not that episode. We're going into it with the expectation that you have a basic understanding of special needs trusts. If you would like to review an episode that goes into an overview of first and third party trusts, there's going to be a link in the show notes to some past episodes I've done. So today we're talking about Kim's favorite trust provisions, and there are four of them. We're going to talk about allowing trustees to have the trust own the home and charge rent to the beneficiary, allowing trust assets to fund an ABLE account, the SECURE Act, and finally, we're going to talk about allowing trustees to pour assets over into a pooled trust. During the discussion, we did cover what classifies a large amount of money or a reasonably large amount of money with regards to picking trustees, because that's a question we get a lot. Towards the end of the episode, Kim explains what the magic language is that you should see in your trust. And I know I put this disclaimer in the episode. I want to say it again. Kim is an attorney. She is not your attorney. She is licensed in Georgia. This is not meant to be advice, legal advice. This is meant to be very general overview for knowledge. If you want to do a deeper dive, a deeper discussion with Kim or with any professional, please find a professional in your state that can have that discussion with you. And the topics we cover do go into some very dangerous waters if you try doing it yourself. I really encourage you to work with professionals to explore these. Thanks for listening. Let's dive in. Welcome, everyone. Today I have back with me Kim Martin. She's the special needs attorney from Georgia who last was on ABC's Disability Planning Podcast back in Season 2, Episode 11. I'll have a link in the show notes. And as a reminder, although Kim is an attorney, she is not your attorney. Anything we are talking about today is for general purposes only. It is not meant to cover your specific legal, whatever you need legally. And you can tell I'm not a professional voiceover guy. The bottom line is, if you are looking for legal advice, don't get it here. Talk to an attorney that has signed a retainer agreement with you and has that air of confidentiality and all the other things that attorneys have when you have a formal agreement in place. This is not a formal agreement. This is Kim sharing with me today her favorite special needs trust provisions. It is not legal advice. Kim, is that a good enough disclaimer?
I think that was perfect.
Awesome. Well, welcome back. Thank you for coming back on the podcast. I didn't scare you off.
Thank you for having me. Last time was fun.
Yeah, you're amazing. You've got so much knowledge, and this is going to be a nice switch from my point of view. Not that I don't mind talking to you about divorce, and you know, because that's how I first found out about you, was you're speaking at the special needs conference down at Stetson in Florida. And as I understand, you still consult nationally with attorneys around the country, but really your passion, as it were, is special needs planning, right? I mean, that's really where you really, really thrive.
That is my favorite thing to do of all the things that I do. And it's the majority of my practice, probably.
And you were sharing you're the only special needs planner in your firm.
Yes. So I'm at a national firm now. So we have offices all over the country. And we have one special needs planner in Chicago who is trying so hard to retire, and she's so indispensable that her clients won't let her, but she's backing out the door.
And so, the firm and other the firm than you're that, with is Harrison me. Held, right? You're with, yes, Harrison Held, and you're in Georgia. Whereabouts in Georgia? Right.
I'm in the Atlanta office.
Okay. But you can serve all of Georgia.
Yes, I'm licensed to practice in Georgia, and I think I am hopefully a few weeks away from being licensed to practice in Illinois as well.
Oh, wow. So by the time this airs, we're recording this in April 12th, 2023. It'll probably air mid to late May. So by then, you'll definitely be licensed. And
I hope so. I mean, it depends how long it takes them to process the application, but it's underway.
Do they have reciprocity? I mean, do you have to?
They do.
Okay.
Yeah, I did not have to take another bar exam.
Sweet. So let's dive right into the deep end of the pool. We're going to talk about special needs trusts today. All we're going to talk about today is special needs trusts. And we're going to focus on some of your provisions, because provisions are really what make or break how successful the trust is for the individual it's put in place for, correct?
Yep. A trust is only as good as the terminology that's in there. And the trustee doesn't have any powers unless we give them to them. Or the law gives the trustee some powers, but we can expand on those powers if we are drafting our trust properly.
So let's start with a softball. What is a special needs trust, and what does a trustee do?
Well, a special needs trust, just like any trust, is a basket that holds whatever you want to put into it, subject to the limitations and the parameters established within the trust. And a special needs trust is a particular type of trust. This is really important if we have a child who is or wants to be qualified for benefits like SSI and Medicaid. So a special needs trust is a particular type of trust that has magic language in it that causes Social Security and Medicaid to disregard the assets that are in the trust. So they know about them, but they consider the assets that are in a special needs trust to be what's called an exempt resource, meaning you could have $10 million in a special needs trust and your child could still qualify for SSI and Medicaid. So that's an important distinction, because if your child is the beneficiary of a trust that isn't a special needs trust, if it's some other kind of a trust that doesn't have the magic language that makes it a special needs trust, then the assets in that trust are not considered to be an exempt resource, and they'll count against your child for purposes of the $2,000 means test.
And then the trustee is just the person that manages all that, does all the work.
Yeah, the trustee is kind of the embodiment of the trust. The trustee's job is to take title to the trust assets on behalf of the trust and manage those assets in the way that they're directed to under the trust provisions, make distributions in ways that are allowed under the trust. And
awesome.
The trustee also does all of the accounting. They do the tax return, or they hire somebody. They don't necessarily have to personally do it, but they are in charge of seeing to it that the taxes get paid and the return gets filed every year if it's a type of trust that has to have its own separate tax return. They do the annual reporting to Medicaid.
Awesome.
So they do all the paperwork. They do all the administrative stuff. And they also manage the money. So they figure out, we need to have a liquid pot of money that we're going to be making distributions from. And we also, if we have enough money left after that, we want to invest some of it in a way that's safe, but that's going to make it grow.
That's awesome. Thank you, Kim. And I want to add my two cents that although you can talk to probably just about any attorney to draft a special needs trust because it's a legal document, please don't go to somebody that might draft one or two a year. Please go to somebody that is maybe a member of NALA, the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, or a member of the Academy of Special Needs Planners, or has some evidence that they do this for a, you know, this is all they do, because there are nuances, and we're going to get into those, where if they don't do it correctly, as Kim just said, and doesn't have the, in quotes, magic language, you could be up a creek, and you may not know it until Medicaid says, hey, or Social Security says, hey, this trust's been in place for 3-4 years. We just got around reviewing it and we've decided we don't like it. We're taking away benefits and you owe us 4 years of pay.
Yep, that
I've
can
seen
happen.
So where do you want to start? What is your tip-top most favorite provision?
Oh, my most favorite provision. I think my very favorite provision that you can have in a special needs trust is the provision that allows the trustee to own a home. And I also always give the trustee the discretion to charge rent or not. And there are lots of reasons why I love that provision. It lets us do a lot of planning and it keeps things very flexible. So when you're drafting any trust, you're doing it in a fixed moment in time, and you're trying to look ahead into the future and anticipate every situation that might happen in the whole lifetime of the beneficiary. So that's a tall order. And so it's a really good idea to build in opportunities for people to plan later. So the provision that allows the trustee to own a home and lets the trustee decide whether the beneficiary can live in the home rent-free or whether to charge rent, that gives us a lot of flexibility because, for one thing, if the trust owns the home, and we're talking about a third-party special needs trust. We should maybe back up a little bit and say, if you have a third-party special needs trust, that's a trust that's designed to hold third-party assets. So that's mom and dad's assets, grandma and grandpa's assets, assets that belong to anybody in the world except the beneficiary. So that's different from a first-party special needs trust. The first-party trust holds the beneficiary's assets. So if the child inherits assets, let's say, directly, we can't put those assets into a third-party trust. We might have to use a first-party trust. And the big difference between those two is that the first-party trust is subject to Medicaid payback at the child's death. So you don't want to put a home in the first-party trust because Medicaid's going to take it at the end of the child's life. But if we have a provision in our third-party special needs trust that allows the trustee to own a home, one of the benefits of having that provision there is if the trustee owns the home and the beneficiary lives there, that means that the trustee has a duty to take care of the home because the home is a trust asset. So the trustee is supposed to know about it. If the roof is leaking, if the wiring is bad, if the carpet needs to be replaced, the trustee is supposed to know about that and they're supposed to use trust assets to take care of it. So it imposes a fiduciary obligation on the trustee to take care of the place where our special needs beneficiary is going to be living. Another thing that the trustee has an obligation to do is periodically check out the home because, again, it's a trust asset. And if the trustee finds out that there is some random guy sleeping in the bathtub because our sweet trusting beneficiary met them at the bus stop and brought them home, the trustee can say, no, you're not supposed to be here. You're going to have to leave. And they have the authority to say that because they own the home and they are the landlord. The trustee can also and should determine things like, is there a meth lab in the kitchen? Is something going on here that we think is not okay? The trustee has a duty to know about that and to do something about it. So that's one reason that it's great to have that provision in place. But then there's another reason that has to do with one of my favorite things, which is money laundering. And we've talked about this before. But as I said, you can't put first party assets, the beneficiary's assets, into a third party trust. The beneficiary can't make a gift to the trustee of their money and say, here, you keep this safe for me in the third party trust that doesn't have a Medicaid payback. You can't do that. But what you can do is charge the beneficiary rent. And if we charge our beneficiary rent and they're paying that rent to the trustee, we are essentially laundering the beneficiary's money into that third party trust. And it doesn't really cost the beneficiary anything if we're charging rent, because what the beneficiary is doing is paying rent into this basket that's there to take care of them. That's also a way to keep the beneficiary's bank balance below $2,000. Even if they're on SSDI, which is not means tested, we still care about the means test because of all those great Medicaid waivers out there. So if we want an easy way to just carve out some of the beneficiary's money every month in one fell swoop, then we can charge the beneficiary rent, and that helps to keep their bank balance under that $2,000 means tested amount. And then a third thing that's nice about giving the trustee the power to charge rent is that if our beneficiary is on SSI, then the trustee can charge them for food and shelter, which would include being allowed to live in the home that's owned by the trust. And that will prevent Social Security from taking a one-third reduction from SSI for in-kind support and maintenance.
Yeah, and I want to circle back on a couple of things here. Let's go back to the money laundering aspect. Even if the, like, my, let's say my son has a first party trust, because he will, because my survivor benefit plan is going to go into it. So, you know, he's going to get $2,000 or $3,000 a month, you know, every month in that trust. There may be reasons to use the first party trust to pay the rent, even though if he, and he won't be on SSI, but just, I'm overcomplicating this. If you pay rent from a first party trust or a third party trust, you will very likely have Social Security reduce your SSI benefit for in-kind support and maintenance. That in and of itself is not a reason to say I am never going to pay rent out of a special needs trust. In my opinion.
And the way you would avoid that problem is, and this is another one of my favorite trust provisions, is that you can have a provision in either one of those types of trusts that allows the trustee to use trust assets to fund an ABLE account. So if the trust puts money into an ABLE account, and then the ABLE account pays rent for the beneficiary, then it's not considered to be in-kind support and maintenance. So you don't get that one-third reduction.
Right. And but, if the child is on SSDI, there would be no one-third reduction anyway.
Right.
If they were getting disabled adult child benefit.
Yeah, that rule only applies
benefit.
To SSI.
Yeah. So like in but, my
but
son's
yeah,
case.
You absolutely yeah. can have the first party trust paying rent on behalf of the beneficiary into the third party trust.
And that's legal. It's not, you're not gifting anything. It's all above board.
Yep. It's an arm's length transaction. So, I mean, you have to charge fair market value rent. You can't charge $10,000 a month or something in rent. But as long as you're charging a rent amount that you can honestly say without, you know, blushing that it's the fair market value for the rental of that home, you know, there's nothing wrong with the first party trust paying rent to the landlord. And if the landlord is the trustee of the third party trust, then that's okay. So then you're taking money out of both of those trusts are exempt baskets. So for benefits purposes, right here and now, it doesn't matter which basket they're in. But later at the child's death, we want to have as little money as possible in the first party trust because there's a Medicaid payback. The third party trust doesn't have a required Medicaid payback. So the assets in that trust can go wherever you want them to go.
Going back to the trustee has a duty to take care of the home, that doesn't necessarily mean because a lot of trustees may not have a lot of experience being property managers. And that's where they can hire a property manager, they can hire a landscaper to come out, like I have somebody coming up to do my yard every other week. They can do all that. They don't have to come out and push a lawnmower or come out and, you know, do the inspection. They may want to come out with the inspector when they hire like a home inspector, just like you would when you're buying a house. You know, you could come out with the inspector once a year or something and take the notes and then figure out what's required, you know, but it doesn't have to be the trustee doing the actual inspections.
Right. They have a duty to know what's wrong with the house, if there is anything wrong, but they can find that out by hiring an inspector. I mean, I can't look at my plumbing and tell you what's wrong with it. Yeah, I have to call a plumber.
And I just want to spell that out for people because how overwhelming this can be for parents, you know, when you're trying to figure all this out, I'm sure it can sound like, oh my gosh, one more thing I have to do or one more thing I have to plan for. And no, if you get a professional trustee and, not necessarily a family member, a lot of these professional trustees have things in place already.
Well, and that's actually a good point, and it's something to note that if you are creating your third-party special needs trust and if you're naming a corporate trustee, which is a good idea if you have enough assets to make it worth the corporate trustee's while to take the trust, if you do have this provision in your trust, and if you want the trust to own a home that your child is going to live in, make sure that you choose a corporate trustee that will own real estate, because some of them won't. It's a lot more trouble to own a home than it is to own a stock portfolio. So some corporate trustees will own real estate and some of them won't.
Thank you.
So it's a question to ask when you're choosing a corporate trustee.
Thank you for bringing that up. And the same goes for pooled trusts. There are some pooled trusts out there that will own real estate, not many that I'm aware of. And a pooled trust is just, well, I'm not going to go into that here. It's another option. I don't know how to explain it quickly, Kim. I'm not very.
Yeah. Well, a pooled trust, it works kind of like a mutual fund. So typically they hold smaller amounts of money, but what happens is, instead of you going to a lawyer and paying for somebody to draft you a private trust that says what you want it to say and has the provisions that you want, you can join a pooled trust that's already in existence. And the way you join is you sign a trust agreement that they already have. They hand it to you and they say, sign here. And you get to decide who the remainder beneficiary will be if it's a third party trust, but you don't get to decide very much else. But what you get is, if you're a member of the pool, is you get the economies of scale, just like you do with a mutual fund, where the trustee takes your bunch of money and a whole bunch of other people's bunches of money, and they put it all into one pot and they manage it all as one unit. They manage it like one big giant investment, and then they allocate out the gains and the losses and the taxes, just like when you put your money into a mutual fund with millions of other people. So you pay less to have a professional trustee managing your money if it's in a pooled trust, but you don't get as much flexibility.
Yeah. And I have come across a couple pooled trusts that will be the trustee for a trust you have drafted. I've come across a couple, but not many.
Yeah. So, generally they have a joinder agreement and they just say, here it is.
Yeah.
Sign at the bottom.
So we've covered, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about with the provision that allows trustee to own the home and charge rent to the beneficiary?
I think that's everything, unless you have any questions or if you think I've missed anything.
No, you're phenomenal. And then I was the one that jumped ahead and got you to talk about the provision to allow trusts to fund the ABLE account.
Right. And that's a good idea too, because now ABLE accounts, keep in mind, also have a Medicaid payback at the child's death. So we don't necessarily want to go out of our way to put a bunch of money into an ABLE account. An ABLE account is a parking space. So if your child has some random bit of money, if they end up, you know, with $5,000 from somewhere and you need to get rid of it quickly, and you don't want to go to the expense of creating a first party trust for that fairly small amount of money, that's when the ABLE account is useful. But the one reason that a trustee might want to put money from a third-party trust into an ABLE account is that in-kind support and maintenance rule that we were talking about. So if you're on SSI and your food and shelter costs get paid for by any source other than SSI or an ABLE account, then Social Security will say, well, you're getting in-kind support and maintenance. Somebody is giving you food and shelter or subsidizing your food and shelter costs. And so obviously you don't need all of this $914 a month that we're giving you. So we're going to reduce your benefit by a third. So the way that you avoid that is, if you've got a third party trust that's already funded and operating, and you have a beneficiary who's on SSI, and if they're in some type of a living situation where we don't get to control what their food and shelter costs are, so maybe they're in a private facility, for example, that costs more than $914 a month, then we can have the ABLE account pay the overage that we need to make up for after we've used up all the SSI money. And because it's coming out of an ABLE account, we don't get that one-third reduction. Whereas if we just paid the extra directly out of the trust, that would be in-kind support and maintenance, and there would be a one-third reduction.
And there is a caveat to that. Right now, they're reviewing the rule to count food for in-kind support and maintenance. It's under review. They haven't decided anything yet, but there is a possibility that goes away.
Yep. We might find out in October at Stetson.
Fingers crossed.
We'll see.
that it goes through. So that's two provisions. What's next?
Well, there's something called the Secure Act and this is the former tax lawyer in me. I never get to talk about taxes anymore. And now I get to because of the Secure Act. So I love the Secure Act, but a lot of people don't love it. But your third party trust should absolutely have provisions that address how we're going to manage retirement assets based on these rules that have just been handed to us under the Secure Act. So I should probably back up a little bit and tell you what that is. The Secure Act was passed at the end of 2019, and it became effective in January of 2020. So it hasn't been around that long. But the big thing that the Secure Act did was it dramatically changed the way that the way that retirement assets get handled if you inherit an IRA. So under the old rules, if you inherited an IRA, much of the time you could use your actuarial life expectancy to figure out what your required minimum distributions were going to be from that IRA. So the longer your life expectancy is, the more years you have, according to the IRS, to take out all that money. So if we're doing the math based on a much younger person, they have more years left in their life expectancy. They can take a smaller required minimum distribution. And if we're dealing with a traditional IRA, which requires you to pay income tax on the money when it comes out, then we're reducing the tax liability of that beneficiary because they can take out a smaller piece of that IRA every year. And they can therefore pay less in taxes. So those are the old rules. Under the Secure Act, unless you meet one of five exceptions, you now have 10 years to take all the money out of an IRA if you inherit it. And therefore, you have 10 years to realize income tax on all that money. So if you inherit $1 million IRA, and you're now subject to the 10-year rule, that means you have 10 years to take $1 million out of that IRA and pay taxes on it on top of your other taxable income. So that is not a great change for most people. Most people were not super happy when the Secure Act passed, but here's why I love the Secure Act, because my families are in that rare group of people that fit one of the exceptions under the Secure Act. So the surviving spouse still gets the same good deal that they always got. They can stretch the IRA over their life expectancy. But if you are a disabled person or a trust for a disabled person, then you also meet one of those five exceptions, which means if you have three children and one of them has a special needs trust, then if you divide your traditional IRA by three, two of your kids are going to have 10 years to take all the money out and pay taxes on it. But your child, who's the beneficiary of a special needs trust, has his whole life expectancy to take out that money. So that's a smaller tax liability every year because we're required to take out a smaller dollar amount that's subject to income tax. Also, you're shifting your income, your taxable income, to the child who probably has the lowest taxable income of any of the kids. So you've got somebody in a very low income tax bracket who's taking a very small amount compared to everybody else out of this inherited IRA, and therefore paying the smallest amount of taxes of anybody in the family on that IRA. So these days, that's one of those red flags that I look for when I'm looking at a client's assets. If I see clients that have some traditional IRAs and some Roth IRAs, if you have a Roth IRA, then you pay the taxes when you put the money in. So you don't have to pay income tax when you take the money out. So if you have a mixture of traditional and Roth IRAs, it's a really good idea to consider naming your child's third-party special needs trust as the beneficiary of your traditional IRAs, and then leaving the Roth IRAs to the other kids.
Yeah, or look into conversions. I mean, this is where you'd really want to consult with a tax planner and do your planning, because there's so many different options here.
That is a very general description of the big picture kind of planning that you could do if you have those types of assets. But if you're going to leave a traditional IRA to a third-party special needs trust, which is now for those income tax reasons, it's a good tax planning strategy to do that. You need to make sure that your trust addresses how we're going to deal with that IRA, especially with regards to the changes under the SECURE Act. So I always include a provision that directs the trustee, we still want you to take the required minimum distribution as you have to in order to be allowed to stretch the IRA, but we can't have the trustee taking that required minimum distribution and handing it to the beneficiary, because then we're creating income for Social Security purposes, not for income tax purposes. And we don't want to do that. That's a problem. So rather than have the trustee handing that RMD to our beneficiary, we can tell the trustee, if you take this money out of the IRA in a manner that causes it to be subject to income tax, and then stick it in another bank account under the umbrella of the trust, that will make the IRS happy because we've triggered income tax, which is really all they care about. And it will also satisfy Social Security and Medicaid because we haven't made a distribution of cash into the child's hands. So there has to be a provision in the trust that gives the trustee some guidance about how to walk that fine line and keep the IRS and all the benefits happy.
Now, and that would be paid, the child would pay the income tax on that, or would the trust pay the income tax on that?
Well, I mean, the income tax liability would belong to the child, but the trust could pay the income tax for the child.
Got it. And again, this is super complicated stuff. Please don't take any of this as tax advice. Please work with a professional.
Yeah.
In a perfect world, you'd be working with a professional while you're setting all this up, not leaving it for whoever comes behind you to untangle.
Yes. It's much better to do it right the first time than it is to have to fix it later.
And if you're looking at having your children be a co-trustee or the trustee or other family members, involve them in the planning. Bring them in when you're having these discussions with your tax planner, your tax attorney, your state attorney. Bring them in there for those conversations. At least that's my opinion. Kim, I mean, what do you think?
Yep, I agree with you. I think things go the best, in my opinion, if everybody works together from day one.
Yeah, I mean, I know people have talked to me about, well, I don't want my other children knowing how much I'm leaving them, or... But they're going to, you know, if you're going to name them as a trustee, they're going to find out. I cannot stress that enough. Do not do this in a vacuum. Do not do this by yourself. Do not try to outsmart the IRS. I mean, let's just work with a professional who does it. And if you're an attorney, and even if you do your own, even if you do special needs trusts, don't do your own. Sorry, Kim.
That's okay.
My personal opinion. Do you disagree? Or I mean, I just feel like the cobbler's kids have no shoes. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that, because I know a number of attorneys who I know would do an absolutely fantastic job at doing a special needs trust for me, but I also like being able to mess around with it at will. So when life happens or when the laws change, I just like being able to kind of deal with it.
I get that. You know, when I was a financial advisor, I struggled to hire somebody, you know, so, but I just feel that it's hard to be objective if you're doing it for yourself.
Right. Well, you're right.
So thank you for that great overview of the SECURE Act. It opens up a lot of planning opportunities. There's a lot of things people can do. And I don't think it's something that only, in air quotes, rich people have to worry about. If you are putting a traditional IRA or a 401k or something of any amount, I think this is something you should really have a discussion with your planner about.
Yep, absolutely. And depending on how old you are and what your own tax situation is, you mentioned that one of the planning strategies that people started to use when the SECURE Act was passed is rolling over traditional IRA money, rolling it over into a Roth, which means you're going to pay taxes on it in the year that you roll it over. But later down the road, you know, if you only have people that are going to be subject to the 10-year rule, you're saving them from having to incur a lot of income tax in a pretty short period of time.
Yeah.
Or so even if you have nothing but traditional IRAs and you have multiple children and your plan was to divide those IRAs equally among the kids, you might want to think about, you know, and again, this is a conversation to have with a financial planner. I'm not saying just go do this, but talk to your financial planner about the idea of maybe rolling over some of that traditional IRA money into a Roth account and then leaving that Roth IRA to the children that are not going to be able to escape the 10-year rule.
Yeah, there's so much there. You know, you can
and some people have also, you know, the relationship between life insurance and IRAs has changed tremendously because of the SECURE Act. So life insurance used to be the classic thing that people would direct towards a special needs trust. And now, because of the tax implications of leaving an IRA to your neurotypical kids, now people are sort of looking at it and going, well, why don't we put all of the traditional IRA money into the special needs trust and we'll compensate for that by, you know, naming all of the kids as the beneficiary of this life insurance policy that we had previously planned on putting into the special needs trust. Because life insurance comes out, it gets distributed tax-free.
Yeah.
So the recipient of a life insurance policy doesn't pay taxes on it.
Yeah, no, that's, again, please don't try to do this without consulting with an expert. I mean, Kim and I are only touching on a few of the options, and even within those options we've touched on, there's so much more nuance than we can get into on a podcast. Just really, really consider working with a professional, even if it's a, you know, on an hourly basis where you hire somebody for one engagement and you say, look, I just want you to help me figure this out.
But if you do that, also, I think it's a good idea to find a financial planner who works with special needs families, because to me, this SECURE Act provision is enormous, but I have met financial planners who don't even know that it exists.
Oh my gosh.
Because, right, I know. But a lot of financial planners just don't work with families that qualify for that exception. Right. So they don't think about it and they don't know about it.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I work with financial planners around the country to help them figure if they've got, because they get that one-off family that, you know, it's not their target market, but if they have a family they're helping. And I've consulted with them on, but I don't get into the financial side. I'm not licensed for that. So, wow. I don't remember how many provisions you said you had.
I think those were my top four.
I have three. I have trustee owns a home, trustee fund able account, and then the SECURE Act, how to handle retirement accounts.
Yeah, it was those three. And then also allowing the trustee. Oh, maybe we haven't talked about this yet. We talked about pooled trusts, but I like to have a provision in the trust that allows the trustee to pour over the assets into a pooled trust.
Okay. See, I'm getting ahead of myself.
We haven't talked about that one yet. But so that's nice if we end up with, you know, we may start with $1 million or $2 million in a special needs trust. And then as our beneficiary goes through life, of course, we're going to spend that money. And if we get to the point where we've got a corporate trustee who's taken that trust on because it had enough money in it to interest a corporate trustee, and then later down the line, we've spent enough of the money so that the corporate trustee says, you know, I can't really charge you what I need to charge you to manage this relatively small amount of money. So if we have a provision that lets the trustee pour money over just take what's left in the trust and convert it into a pooled trust. Pooled trusts will take a relatively small amount of money. So they don't have $1 million minimum, which
is on the low end. Because I'm sure people are like, well, what's a large amount? I've seen corporate trustees who won't take accounts less than 5 million. You know, a lot of the banks
absolutely.
And stuff.
Yeah. I mean, a million is about the bottom of the minimums that I see. So if I see a family where if we're doing planning and we're expecting to have maybe $500,000 in the trust, I mean, that's not a tiny bit of money.
Right.
That's a lot of money, but good luck finding a corporate trustee that will take on a trust that has $500,000 in it. Yeah. So maybe we name, you know, family members, siblings, or, you know, anybody that we have who's a family member or a friend as our successor trustee. But chances are, if we have a young beneficiary and we're naming people who are our level, our generational level, at some point we're going to run out of people. So at that point, it's nice to be able to turn to a pooled trust and hand over the remaining trust assets.
I'm still not a huge fan of having family members as trustees just because
there's
so much
work
involved.
What are you
going
to do if you have $500,000 to put in a trust?
Well, I would probably
not going to get Wells Fargo to take it.
No, but I would probably go right to the pooled trust and maybe have a family member, if a family member was interested in being involved, be a family member as a trust protector, you know, to help, you know, make sure that the individual with disability, that their voice was heard.
And that's an option. Again, this depends so much on what your family is like.
Yeah, because I'm coming from a place where I don't want anybody. If my brother was my son's trustee, I'm afraid that he would find ways to justify the money being spent, even though it's supposed to be used for the benefit of. There's ways you can spend it for the benefit of without really benefiting.
Yeah, and if that's a worry that you have, then definitely that is not your ideal successor trustee. So it just depends. I mean, some of my clients have, you know, four kids and one of them is a special needs child and one of them is a lawyer and one of them is a CPA. And I mean, I have siblings of special needs kids tend to be very impressive people. So, you know, if you've got this deep bench of successor trustees who are qualified to handle the money and who you trust not to waste it or steal it or do something crazy with it, then maybe you want a family member to be the trustee because you know they're going to care about your child. They're going to do the best they can for the child, you know, and you can trust them. If you don't have somebody like that, then you need to look around. And if you don't have bare minimum $1 million that's going to head into the third party special needs trust, then you're probably going to need to look at a pooled trust.
Yeah. And there are some attorneys out there, I don't know how many nowadays, that would take on smaller accounts, the you know, the million to 5 million range or and they would serve as trustee and they were less expensive than a big corporate trustee. So there are other options that people can look in their area. The mm-hmm. you know, my challenge with that would be continuity. If that attorney retired or fell ill or whatever, who's taking over, you know?
Right.
No, that's a lot to think about. That is a lot to think about. When you're looking at these trusts, probably a really dumb question, but does it spell out provision when you're reading a trust document or how do you know that these provisions are in there?
Well, I mean, they're going to be in the trust in various locations in the trust. So, you know, like there's going to be a section of the trust that says trustee powers.
Okay.
Here are all the things that my trustee is allowed to do. So some of these provisions would be in the trustee powers. There's probably a section of the trust that says something like administrative provisions. Okay. And that might be where you would find language about things like the Secure Act and how we're going to deal with IRAs. But yeah, the trust should have sections, you know, with headings that tell you, here's the category of things that this section is going to address. And most of these would be found in the trustee powers.
And how do you know that you have a special needs trust?
If you have a trust, and again, this is, please don't take this as 100% true 100% of the time, because if the trust is messed up, then it's not true. But the magic language that you should have to make something be a special needs trust is if you say, my intention is for these trust assets to supplement and not supplant any benefits that the child might be entitled to. So that's why sometimes you'll hear it called a supplemental needs trust instead of a special needs trust. Yes. But in either case, the way that you know that you're looking at a special needs trust is if there's a provision that says that the grantor's intention is for the trust assets to supplement and not supplant any benefits that the child is on.
Okay.
So there are other ways that you could mess up the trust and make it not be a special needs trust, even if that language is in there. So
that's
like
where
you could
really want to talk to an expert who does all of it. Because if you're working with somebody who does one or two trusts a year, odds are they're going to plug it into software that's going to spit out. Maybe not, but I mean, I don't know. Maybe I should just stop before I get myself in trouble.
Well, it's just, this is such a highly specialized area of trust drafting that, you know, there are trusts that are drafted by people who draft trusts all day long, but if they don't do special needs trusts, they just don't know which provisions shouldn't be in there or need to be there.
And you can't rely on Social Security and Medicaid to review the trust in a timely manner and tell you, we're not going to accept this. You know, it can take years. I've seen people where it has taken years for Social Security to come back to them.
Yeah. And you should submit your trust to Medicaid for approval. And I, you know, that we can't make Medicaid review it quickly, but.
Yeah, I think my attorney did that for me because I know he had to submit it to the state. And I think he just did it to Medicaid at the same, because Maryland, first party trust has to be approved by, you know, the state. And then, but that's something to ask your attorney. Will you submit it, or what do I need to do? And now this was awesome. And I'm glad we were able to go deeper than this is a first party, this is a third party, because I've done those before. I really want to talk to those of us out there that are trying to get more than just the basics. There, you know, I haven't heard anybody else have discussions like this, so I really appreciate you doing this, Kim.
Well, I'm happy to. Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. Can you share with people how they can get in touch with you if they live in Georgia and are looking for legal advice around special needs planning?
Sure. The easiest thing to do is probably to email me. And if I had slides, I would put it up on a slide right now, but I don't. So my email address is kmartin, K-M-A-R-T-I-N, @harrisonheld.com. Or you can call my office line, which is 404-567-4154. It's very hard to get me on the phone, so very likely you're going to get my voicemail, but I'm pretty good about getting back to people.
And this information will be in the show notes if you're driving or walking your dog or whatever. Like you can tell Ryla's in the podcast. You know, don't worry about trying to write it down. It's in the show notes. You know, the email will be there. The link to her website with her profile will be there. No, this has been awesome. Thank you very much, Kim.
Well, thank you for letting me come back.
I hope you took away a few nuggets from this interview with Kim. I know I'm going to be going back to look at my trust, because Kim and I were talking after we stopped recording about when my trusts were done, and the fact that more than likely they don't have any language in them about the Secure Act, because the Secure Act came out after I had my trust done, and I just haven't reviewed it. So it's something to think about. If your trust was done before 2016 when ABLE accounts came around, or 2019 when the Secure Act came around, take a look at your trust and see if it has the provisions that we talked about. We also wanted to clarify that the house that the trust owns and the trustee has power over doesn't have to be the house you're in. The trustee can sell the house that maybe because it's too large or too run down or whatever. The trustee, the intent is to allow the trustee to buy a new house or sell the house you're in That was the intent. Again, I really enjoy having Kim on as a guest. She's so, so knowledgeable. I'm thinking about having her back to do a mini series on estate planning and when you have a child with special needs or when you have a child with a disability, because there's so many topics that I want to get into, and it's such a complicated topic to discuss. But I'm hesitant because I started this podcast as a intro. That's why I call it the ABCs of Disability Planning, and I don't want to go too deep into the weeds for if it's not going to benefit you, the listener. So give me some feedback. Let me know if you'd like to hear a deep dive from Kim. I'd really like to know. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing, sharing the podcast and this episode with others you think will benefit. And if you're so inclined, please leave me a review. It's how I get the feedback to know what I'm doing right, what I could do better, you know, things like that. Thank you.